today I'm going to be talking about these line retrotransposons. And this is one of the cases of a spurious observation that I had the opportunity, because of the MESA environment, and also fortunate to have like a supervisor like Rusty Gage, to follow up on that observation and make another discovery. So we work with neurostem cells, and neurostem cells can be isolated from the adult brain using a Pericle gradient of density, and we can place these neurostem cells in culture, and under the right condition, in the presence of FGF2, the cells will proliferate and will keep dividing. So if we withdraw FGF2, so we remove those factors, SOX2, which is a transcription factor that keeps the cells in a proliferating mode, will induce the cells to differentiate. And we can guide the cells to differentiate into three main lineages of the nervous system, such as astrocytes, neurons, and oligodendrocytes. So what we observed, and this was early days when I arrived in the lab as a postdoc, was that all the time when we induce these neurostem cells to differentiate into neurons, we detect this increased expression of line retrotransposons. So line retrotransposons are a class of mobile elements, or also known as jumping genes. So they are discrete DNA regions in the genome, and they have this remarkable ability to duplicate and to insert themselves in a different regions of the genome. So all the time when they land into the genome, they may affect nearby gene expression. So they were first discovered by Barbara McClintock, who won the Nobel Prize in 1983. And she actually postulated that these mobile elements are controlling genes that can affect gene expression, creating what we call a genetic mosaicism. So how they move? So they use this copy and paste mechanism. So here is one line element. So it's composed by an endogenous 5' UTR region that works as a promoter region that will drive the expression of two open reading frames, ORF1 and ORF2, ORF1 being RNA chaperone, and ORF2 is an interesting protein that has two domains. One is the endonuclease domain, and the other one is a reverse transcriptase. So upon transcription, the RNA moves to the cytoplasm, where it forms this ribonuclear protein complex that will take advantage of the nuclear membrane breakdown to get back to the nucleus, where the endonuclease domain will scan the DNA looking for the specific target site and will make a nick, exposing this 3' OH in the DNA strand that would be used as a primer for the reverse transcriptase to transcribe the RNA. So what is interesting is that this reverse transcription is not very processive, and we don't know exactly why. But as a consequence, what we have is not a faithful copy of the original one, but is often mutated in the 5' UTR region. So the new insertion cannot move again, but the original one can still produce novel insertions. So as I told you, all the time when these new insertions land into the genome, you can create insertions and also deletions. You can mess up with gene regulation. You can induce recombination, even creating new splicing sites. So they're very creative agents to model or to shape the genomic structure. So in contrast to 2% or less than 2% of coding sequence in the human genome, we have about 50% of the human genome composed by mobile elements, retro elements, and sequences that were derived from these retro elements. 17% actually corresponded to line retrotransposons, and sometimes I'll just refer to L1s. And lines are long interspersed nucleotide elements, and most of them, the majority of them, are mutated or truncated because of these retrotransposition characteristic that they have. But nonetheless, around 150 in the human genome is still highly active. And in the mouse, we have at least 3,000 elements that are still able to move around and can cause mutations. And we can detect that. So the question was, can those retro elements be detected in vivo? So to do that, we create a transgenic animal where we tagged one active human line element with an indicator cassette. So the indicator cassette is the EGFP gene that has an intronic region that will not be expressed unless one round of retrotransposition can be spliced out the intron, and then we have the EGFP, and we can see the cells that support line retrotransposition. So we generate the animals, we scan all the tissues, and the only region where we could find line retrotransposition was in the germ cells and in the brain. So there are several cells that turn out to be EGFP positive cells, and most of them colocalized with neuronal markers such as Nguyen, but they are excluded from glial markers such as S100 beta. So this suggests that the event is happening on cells that are committed to the neuronal lineage. Moreover, we could sequence some of the insertion sites, and we figured out that around 50% of the insertions were targeting neuronal genes. Moreover, at least in one situation, we could show that one line retrotransposition in a promoter gene could change gene expression and affect the cell fate. And finally, I want to stress that when you see those imaging, this represents just one single line element that we can see, in contrast to over 3,000 endogenous active elements in the mouse genome. So what about in humans? So this observation was validated in humans by Nicole Kofau, who was a grad student in Rusty's lab. And the idea was, if those retro elements are transposing in neuronal cells, we will have an expansion of neuronal genes. So the brain, if you quantify the number of line insertions in the genome of brain cells, we should see an increase because of those somatic mutations, those somatic insertions that has been accumulated over time. And in heart and in liver or other somatic tissue, we should not see that because there is no retrotransposition going on. So she used a quantitative PCR approach, and all in several brain regions, we see an increased number in line sequenced compared to known neuronal cells and known brain cells. So, but how this is regulated? So we decided to look for regulatory elements in the promoter region of lines, and these promoter regions are heavily methylated because they have CPG sites. So when methylated, those CPG sites will attract methyl binding proteins. And I have here the family of methyl binding proteins, and perhaps the most well-known member of this family is MECP2. So as Rusty pointed out in the first section, MECP2, when mutated, can cause Rett syndrome. So I won't go over into the characteristic of Rett syndrome, but I would like to point out that they have like a large spectrum of autistic behavior, very variable. And due to MECP2 mutations, what we have is a prototype of an autism spectrum disorder where we see neurons that lack complexity. So how does MECP2 work? So MECP2 is attracted by methylated CPG islands, CPG sites in target promoter regions, and will form a repressor complex in repressing gene expression. In the absence of MECP2, we don't have the formation of the repressor complex, and we increase the transcriptional noise. So this is just one hypothesis. But can MECP2 repress the line promoter? So first, we use chromatin IP to check the association between MECP2 protein and the line promoter, and we see that the promoter is heavily associated with MECP2 in the stem cells. If we induce the cells to become neurons, the signal is lost. Moreover, if we treat those cells with 5-azacitidine, a demethylating agent, we lose the signal, indicating that the association between MECP2 and the line promoter is methylation dependent. We also check the expression levels, and we first did a luciferase experiment where we cloned the 5' UTR region upstream to the luciferase gene. And as you can see here, in MECP2 knockout cells, the luciferase is highly upregulated compared to MECP2 knockout cells complemented with the wild-type gene or in control cells. And this correlates well with gene expression. So this is a qPCR experiment where in MECP2 knockout cells, you have a higher expression of line retro elements compared to our controls. But can MECP2 regulate line retrotransposition in vivo? So we took advantage of our transgenic animal, and we backcrossed with MECP2 hats to originate a transgenic animal where our indicator cassette was in an MECP2 knockout background. So again, we are looking for EGFP positive cells as an indicator of cells that support line retrotransposition. So we searched in, because MECP2 is expressed in all tissues in the body, we postulated that we perhaps could see retrotransposition in all tissues. That was not the case. We only see line retrotransposition in the brain. And what you have here is a three-dimensional model of the brains in two different genetic backgrounds. Here is the control, and here is the MECP2 knockout background. And every single dot that you see here represents a single neuron that supports at least one round of retrotransposition. And I hope you can appreciate here that although the distribution of line retrotransposition events did not change between the two genetic backgrounds, it's clear that in the MECP2 knockout brains, we have more line retrotransposition going on. And we can isolate different brain regions and quantify the amount of line retrotransposition. And there are several regions where we have like an increased amount of line retrotransposition going on, such as olfactory bulb, the striatum, or the cerebellum seems to be highly affected by this phenomenon. So can we model that in humans? So to do that, we decided to take advantage of the induced pluripotent stem cell system. And as you saw in the previous session, we can model for Rett syndrome using induced pluripotent stem cells. So we decided to take advantage of the same system and now make neuroprogenitor cells from those iPS cells and test and electroporate our indicator cassette and see if the cells can support line retrotransposition. And when we did that, we realized that there is twofold increase in the number of EGFP positive cells in neuronal progenitor cells that were derived from Rett syndrome compared to controls. Can we validate the iPS system in vivo? So to validate that, we took advantage of postmortem brain tissue. The idea is if in neuroprogenitor cells we have an increased amount of line retrotransposition going on, those people they still carry the insertions throughout life. So by taking advantage of this postmortem brain, we compare postmortem brain and also heart from the same individual in Rett syndrome and non-affected people. And this is a qPCR measuring the amount of line DNA amount in those cell in those tissues. And you can see that in Rett syndrome patients, we have an increased amount of line sequence compared to controls. And always when we probe for the nervous system, we confirm the previous data suggesting that all the time the nervous system seems to have like an upregulation of lines, a higher number of line insertions compared to controls. So because this is a qPCR approach, we validated it many times using different primes and probes, and always we have the same result. So our model suggests that MECP2 is perhaps an important factor regulating or repressing the expression of line elements in neurostem cells. As soon as those stem cells start to become committed to the neuronal lineage, we see that the chromatin will get loose and will unleash the expression of these line elements. So the repression repressor complex is dissociated, and that will allow for neuronal activators. And we have some ideas what are these neuronal activators, but I won't be talking about that. But interesting to note that whenever we have this line expression going on, they are now free to get inserted into neuronal genes. And the reason why they go to neuronal genes, I invited you to stop by in the poster 31 with Apua Pakola, postdoc in the lab, who has a clever idea why this may be going on. So how to make sense of that? So what we believe that we are revealing here is a mechanism to generate neuronal diversity. And the idea is that perhaps in the human genome, we don't have, I mean, this is just a hypothesis, we don't have enough information to generate the amount of complexity that is required to make like a smart brain. And this is not a new idea. This is not a novel. So the immune system also uses a transposon-based approach, the VGJ recombination, also to generate somatic diversity, somatic variations to account for the amount of diversity that we need for antibody production. So my take-home message are that we believe that we have strong evidence now indicating that the brain is a genetic mosaicism regarding line sequence. And this is true for mice and also humans. And probably this is just the tip of the iceberg, especially if you take in account other jumping genes or other mobile sequence in the human genome, such as ALUs or SINEs. So MECP2 is a repressor complex that silence the line expression in neurostem cells. And this, we show that this can happen in a MECP2 knockout animal, as well as in Rett syndrome patients. And finally, perhaps most importantly, we believe that this tissue-specific genetic variation challenges this idea of somatic, of static neuronal genes. And this has a clear implication for complex disease such as autism and schizophrenia. Perhaps one should take in account when design GWAS studies. And perhaps this also is related to individuality of our unique brain. So I would just thank members of my group that help with discussions and are continuing this work. Also, Rusty's Gage group, especially Carol Marchetto, who is a key player on this story. Our collaborator, Jean Yu at UCSD, and Kenichi Nakashima in ARA. And I think I will stop here and be happy to take any questions. Thank you. I think this is that.
Okay, any questions? I want to just take a couple of questions now for the next 5 minutes, and then we'll do questions at the end as well.
There's one over there. Okay, in terms of gene jumping, has anyone looked at whether environmental factors can induce greater propensities? And if so, what are the environmental factors? Can they also be positive and negative in terms of changing the combination of nucleotides for gene expression and protein?
That's a good question. We are very interested on those. We published one paper indicating that running can actually induce neurogenesis and probably line jumping in specific brain regions where the neurogenic regions are. Hippocampus, we look into the hippocampus. So by just exposing the animals to the running wheels, you increase the number of jumping genes in the hippocampus. So there are probably other factors that perhaps increase and decrease jumping genes. And we are actively looking for those factors.
Yes. You show that in a Rett syndrome patients, these patients tend to have more line one DNA. On the other hand, you say that these retrotransposons can be accounted for a greater neuronal diversity. Can you reconcile these two ideas that, because you suggest in the Rett syndrome that too much is maybe too much?
Right.
And
right.
What is the mouse phenotype when you miss one of the
right. micro? So I think the idea is that probably, I mean we see line retrotransposition in non-affected brains, in even Y-type animals. And to me, what this suggests is that there is a threshold. There is a normal line where your brain can support such an amount of line retrotransposition. And that may actually contribute to your cognition or to who you are. If you go higher than that, perhaps you start messing up with individual cells. And that will influence networks. And that will influence circuitry. And we start having like some phenotypes. So that's one idea. On the other hand, if you completely reduce line retrotransposition or abolish line transposition, I would imagine that we're going to lose those small influence into the neuronal networks, and we start losing these cognitive abilities that makes you unique.
Ralph Greenspan has a question.
Is there a sex difference in the degree of transposition?
We haven't looked into that. I don't know.
Who's smarter?
Are you ready?
So we'll be talking a lot more about this in the break. Thank you very much, Dr. Motri.